Okay, this is our final hour with Professor Brian Sykes, so we'll take your phone calls with him when we come right back on Coast to Coast AM. Brian, if modern humans, let's say, mated with Neanderthals, they must have had some kind of social interaction. I wonder what that might have been. What do you think?
Well, the mind boggles, really, doesn't it? Well, I think we know already that they did. They were certainly aware of each other's existence in the same landscape. Sometimes they used the same cave. We don't know exactly whether they used them at the same time, but certainly in the Middle East there are caves which were occupied both by modern humans, Homo sapiens, and Neanderthals. I don't know. I mean, I've just about no better idea than anyone else, but you can imagine, for example, and this is the way a lot of animals are thought to have been domesticated, that maybe there's a child, a baby, a young infant of a Neanderthal might have been found lost, or maybe their parents died, or maybe they killed in battle or something, and they would have been maybe taken back to live with the modern humans. Or it could have happened the other way around, of course, and brought up with them and eventually maybe had children with one of the modern humans in there, in that group. I mean, actually, there's even stories of this having happened in recent times. There's a case in, I don't know whether it's true, I'm following this up, but there's a case from Abkhazia in the Caucasus Mountains of a woman, a female, captured in the 19th century, who, by all accounts and descriptions, could well have been a Neanderthal, and she did have children with the Georgians who captured her. I'm looking into that now, but something like that is the likely explanation, I think, rather than what we might imagine to be some sort of mass rape or something of that.
Yeah, or some interaction or something like that. Why did the Neanderthals die off? Why aren't they technically around anymore?
Well, I suppose if they did interbreed with us, technically they still are. But their characteristic skeletons, people of remains of characteristic Neanderthal features, disappeared from the fossil record in Europe, anyway, about 30,000 years ago. Nobody quite knows why it is. I mean, the thing we don't appreciate, I think, as humans, is that actually extinctions in the natural world are happening all the time. There are theories that we, Homo sapiens, outcompeted them for resources and that sort of thing, but this is all very airy-fairy. Nobody really knows.
No, they really don't. Let's take some phone calls for you. Let's go to Beulah, North Dakota. Matt's with us, first-time caller. Hey, Matt, go ahead.
Hey, good morning, guys.
Good.
It's Beulah, by the way.
Beulah,
yeah.
Okay.
Hey, I was just curious about the whole male extinction and all that. And, yeah, you guys brought up a good point about talking about when a male's not present and females are together and they kind of take over the male role. And it kind of made me think about the, you know, kind of the baby boom when the men are at war and dying and you know, and then you have a big boom of a lot of babies and all that. So I was just thinking maybe of human nature and reproducing itself. It just kind of made me think a little bit.
Well, it's always that possibility. Always that possibility, indeed. Brian, do geneticists continue to look at new theories, or are they all pretty cut and dry?
Well, it's individual variation, really. Most academic scientists are charged with having to think up new things to do, I think. They can't rest on their laurels and do the same thing for their whole careers. They'd find themselves left behind. So it's all part of, at least in academic science, and I think also in commercial science too, that you're trying to think of new things to do. A lot of the time, you know, it doesn't work out, or for one reason or other. But you are trying to understand things. And so, for example, this idea of having of two women being able to have a baby.
Strange.
This has been, well, it is strange in a way, yes, it is strange. But funnily enough, there are plenty of species, some American lizards, for example, that seem to have got rid of males altogether and seem to do very well indeed. They're all females, they have all female offspring, and actually, from the point of view of efficiency, you can have a lot more children a lot more quickly like that if you don't have to bother having males. So these species do take over from their sexually reproducing counterparts, and the sexually reproducing species has been eliminated. So, and that's fine until such time as the parasites and other pathogens catch up with them, because in that sort of reproduction, they're all clones, or like genetically identical. So once a virus or another sort of pathogen unlocks the key to infecting a clone, then it whips from one individual to another, can wipe out the species. And so there's plenty of really successful organisms, like dandelions, a lot of strawberries in the plant kingdom, these lizards in the southwest US. They're doing very well indeed without the need for males or sexual reproduction at all.
If somebody receives an organ in a transplant, is there any possibility that those cells possess memory and memory will be carried on where the person actually has recollections of the donor?
Well, you know, and we've talked about a lot of things on this program already tonight that I have got some idea about the answers, but with this, I really have to confess total ignorance. I've got no more idea of whether that's true or not than any of your listeners, and probably less than many of them.
True.
So I'm afraid to say I don't know.
All right. Let's go back to the calls. John is in Brooklyn, New York, east of the Rockies. John, go ahead.
Oh, hi. Thanks very much. A point and a question. Douglas Adams foresaw the direct descendants of men throughout the world being direct descendants of Genghis Khan. I wonder if he ever imagined it would be true. He did that in The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. Question. If I understand you correctly, mutation of a species occurs basically through the reproductive process. Either sperm or egg carry a mutation, or a mutation is created when they fuse.
Well, that's absolutely right, yes. DNA mutations in DNA do generally occur when cells divide, and they occur far more in the male germline. As I think I said already, if a 60-year-old man, his sperm has come from cells divided 1,000 times.
Right.
The number of cell divisions in the female germline is far fewer. It's only 23. Less chance of mutation occurring.
That I think we've proven logically tonight that the egg came first. Male proto chicken mated with female proto chicken, and from that first egg came the first chicken.
That old one, yes. Yes, I think so. Though actually what probably happened is that, and there are some algae that show this already, that sexual reproduction involves the fusion of, in our case, an egg and sperm. In the case of algae, it's the fusion of two cells of approximately equal size. And what happened then was that the little things inside the mitochondria fought to the death in the cell after they'd fused. And so to solve this, what happened was that the outcome of this very fierce DNA battle was fixed. One cell grew much larger, that became the egg. The other cell grew much smaller, that became the sperm.
Are human beings predisposed of carrying on certain traits?
Yes.
Is that? They are. Okay.
Yes, I mean, the DNA will go on from one generation to the next unchanged. So if there's a mutation in one parent, say, there's a good chance depending on the on what it is and how many copies you needed, there's a good chance that DNA will be passed on to one or more of the children, and it will, in many cases, have the same effect as it did in the parents. So that's the way some of the diseases, the genetic diseases, are passed on from one generation to the next. Like the one I used to work on, brittle bone disease, can be passed on in that way. And you get very large families with patients with those diseases in each generation.
Famous ones like hemophilia,
you know, the royal families of Europe have all inherited a hemophilia gene from their ancestors.
Brian, does it take a long time for a DNA to mutate, or does it happen relatively fast?
Well, it happens very fast. It happens when cells divide. When cells divide, each of the two cells that come, the daughter cells, as they're called, after division, each of those have the same amount of DNA as the original cell. So that DNA has to duplicate itself. It's done through a beautiful process from this famous double helix of DNA that unwinds, it copies itself, and then reforms. And it's that copying that goes wrong very, very occasionally. I mean, there are 3,000 million DNA letters in our genome, and the error rate in the copying is in something like 1 in a billion of times that it's copied. So it's very, very small errors. Otherwise, if it was much higher, we'd never look anything like our parents. Nonetheless, those small errors happen quickly during that DNA copying episode when cells divide, and they are carried on through the subsequent divisions. And if those are in the germline, those are the cells that become sperm or egg, stand a good chance of being passed on to children.
Okay, let's go to the phones again. Let's go to John in Tacoma, Washington, west of the Rockies. John, go ahead.
Okay, you asked whether a bone marrow transplant would pass something on to the recipient. My wife died of leukemia, but she had a bone marrow transplant. She used to have long blonde hair, and she was blue-eyed, and when she got a bone marrow transplant, she took on auburn-colored hair, which was rather wavy and curly from the donor. And her personality didn't change or anything, but anyways, she took on certain traits, and I asked her about that, and she said, oh, yeah, you take on certain things. You take on the blood type of the donor, and you take on I was just going to ask, is there some way you could take a drop of blood from every male that's born and come up with the perfect male Y male that could be a donor for the whole country?
Yes, that would be kind of like the artificial Genghis Khan effect, wouldn't it? Have millions of offspring, yes. Well, I think there are probably several men who think they would fit that category without the need for genetic manipulation and do their best to try and propagate their Y chromosomes, sometimes very successfully. As you know, there is a lot of sperm donation has been going on and artificial insemination. Most of the time, there are limits as to how many offspring a donor can have, one donor. I think probably to prevent this megalomania that you might otherwise get, the Genghis Khan effect. And I think you'd have to, there's always going to be differences of opinion about what makes a good sperm donor, really. A lot of them, of course, are medical students, so that's already introducing some sort of genetic bias, I would have thought. However, I think there was a time, for example, when Nobel Prize winners were asked to donate sperm, and they And that program worked quite well for a while, but then again, people began to track back and find out how their fathers really were. That's say the people who'd been born as a result of those. And I think that was dropped after many of them came back and sort of tried to share the life of their Nobel Prize-winning father.
Okay, next up, we've got more. We've got the Fairbanks, Alaska caller, Wayne, on the wild card line. Hi, Wayne.
Hi, guys.
Yeah.
Hello.
Brian, I had a question on when 10, 15 years ago when that show on genetics came out on PBS called Journey of Man, and they were tracking genetic markers of the original peoples, and as they moved throughout the over the earth and populated the different continents. At one point after that, and I think it kind of backed up the biblical flood, but if I recall, they said that at one point there were as few as 65, less than 100 people in a genetic pool to repopulate the... Is there any evidence pointing to that?
Well, there's certainly evidence that the population went through what geneticists like to call a bottleneck, where there's been a sharp reduction in the number of people. I don't remember reading that it was quite as low as 65. But several people have calculated, and it is all done on the basis of a calculation, that number that went through the bottleneck was in the number of low 1,000 or low number of thousands. It's very difficult to be precise. And certainly you can see that kind of effect in many, many parts of the world. For example, I think the most dramatic time I've ever seen that was when I was working in Polynesia, where you have these very far-flung islands, of course, only reached by maybe just one colonizing boat, and that, and you could see the genetic effects of that. Everyone on those islands was genetically, in the genes I was looking at anyway, identical, because they'd come through a bottleneck of just one boatload of original inhabitants. So you do get these things. You do get these effects coming through. Although I don't recall, I know The Journey of Man, Spencer Wales' book and program, I don't recall him having it such a low number, but let's not say it wasn't somewhere in the book.
Okay, next up, let's go to Dan in DeWitt, Iowa. Dan, go ahead, take it away.
Good morning, gentlemen. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm wondering if you can take and harvest a Y chromosome from a perfectly healthy reproductive male and inject that into a female egg, therefore guaranteeing a male would be born who could possibly reproduce.
Yep, you could. You can do that. And and it's already done. That's one of the ways of artificial insemination. You can take the sperm itself and artificially inject it into an egg and get a healthy male offspring or a female offspring. Not all sperm, of course, produce male children. Half of them produce female children.
Well, let me tell you, science is something. Brian, we've got another break. The last one, we'll be back in a moment with final calls and final comments from Professor Brian Sykes on Coast to Coast AM. Well, on our next Coast to Coast program, we're going to talk with James Rollins about Bloodline, the quest for immortality. Make sure you're part of that program. When we come back with Professor Brian Sykes, let's take final phone calls right here on Coast to Coast AM. Brian, tell me about the ClanDonald DNA Project. What is that?
Okay. The ClanDonald is a very big, probably the biggest of the Scottish Highland clans, and with a very distinguished history. When I was doing research for my book, Saxons, Vikings, and Celts, about 2005, or something like that, I was studying the Y chromosomes from all across Britain, and I found one in Scotland that was very unusual, and I only found it in men with the name MacDonald or McAllister or MacDougall. Now, at the time, I didn't know enough about Scottish history But one of my research students reminded me, or told me rather, that all of those clans, that's to say McAllister's, McDonald's and McDougal's, were all supposed to have been descended from one ancestor, a man called Somerled, a Celtic, a hero that that threw out the Norse Vikings from that part of Scotland. And so I thought, well, maybe what I found is Somerled's Y chromosome in his descendants. So I wrote to all the living clan chiefs in those clans, and they all kindly responded, and they all had exactly the same Y chromosome. So this proved it, really. And so in a way, it's kind of like a mini Genghis Khan effect. It was a very powerful dynasty, and where the men in the clan, in the ruling part of the clan, had more offspring than their fair share, and that's the way of the world, really. But what's happened since then is that in America, the Clan Donald Society, which is very well organized and very large, there's probably 200,000 people called McDonald or, in different parts of the world, and there are many of them members of this club. They have got together, they've extended this original piece of work that I did years ago to now include over 1,000 members, all of whom have had DNA tests on their Y chromosome. And they've been able to, well, first of all, to confirm my preliminary results as being correct, and secondly, to identify the 30% of McDonald's or so that are direct descendants of Somerled and direct ancestors, sorry, direct relatives of the clan chiefs. And then other branches that are not descended from Somerled, but nonetheless are important branches within the clan. So it's the world's biggest genetic genealogy project on one family. And there's a chapter about it in DNA USA. It's a very good example of how this kind of work, it started off in academic labs like mine, has gone throughout the world and is now run entirely by interested non-scientists, interested laymen, and they've done a wonderful job.
Are there small companies, Brian, publicly held companies that are emerging in this field?
Well, there are, and they're the ones that do a lot of this testing. When I started, when some of my early work came out, say the work behind the Seven Doors of Eve, my lab was inundated with calls from people who wanted to know, in that case, which of the seven daughters they were descended from. Same with when I did some research to highlight the association between surnames and Y chromosomes. And again, people ring up the lab all the time. So the university in Oxford set up a company called Oxford Ancestors to help cope with this demand, because we really couldn't in our research lab. And that company is still going, and people send us their DNA on a regular basis. Anyone can do that. It's at oxfordancestors.com. And since then, we're the first company to do that. But since then, companies have sprung up in all parts of the world, many of them in America, who are doing the same sort of thing, some in slightly different ways, and some in exactly the same way. And I think there's certainly a demand for it. And I would say probably at least 1 million people have had their DNA looked at in the 10 years or so that these tests have become publicly available. And that's one of the aspects that I explore in DNA USA, how people have used this new genetic genealogy and what its limitations are, what its benefits are, and as in the case of the Clan Donald project, how enormous projects have been planned and executed.
Okay, let's go now to Tustin, California. George, thanks for holding. Go ahead.
First, George, thank you very much for everything you do.
Well, you're welcome. Thank you.
Okay, Brian, my question is regarding the Nobel Peace Prize from 2009 for medicine to the three scientists, and I know of some of what I have somewhat of an understanding of what they did, but they believe they found a way to decrease the amount of mutation or damage to the chromosomes, having to do with the what they call the telomeres, which are caps, protective caps on the end of the chromosome chain, like a plastic tip on a shoelace.
Yes, that's a good analogy. Yes.
Yes, and that they have discovered in their research that there's actually enzymes from plants called telomerase.
That's right, telomerase, yeah.
Right, so, and they are claiming that you can regrow the telomeres. You start out with 10,000 telomeres when you're born, and by the age 60 years of age, you're reduced down to 6, possibly 5,000 telomeres because they break off at the rate of 50 or 100 telomeres per year.
Mm.
And
yeah,
that allows more damage to the chromosome chains. But now they say they can regrow those telomeres back, and you can actually get younger and reverse aging. Do you know anything about telomeres and protecting the chromosome chains, and do you know about their research?
Well, you're certainly right. Yes, I do. You're certainly correct in that telomeres are the pieces of DNA right at the tips of the chromosomes. We have 23 pairs of chromosomes, and they have these tips. They're actually rather hard when chromosomes divide, as they do in each generation of cells. They're rather hard to duplicate properly, just because they happen to be right at the end, and it's technically difficult for DNA to copy itself right at the end of chromosomes without having anything to work from. As a result of that, the more a chromosome divides, the shorter and shorter the telomeres become. And it's fairly certain, but not absolutely certain, that the shortening of telomeres is one determinant of the natural process of aging. So there's been work for quite a while to try and restore the telomeres, and the gentleman you're talking about who won the Nobel Prize have done some important work on that. It's not clear to me how it is that they intend to reverse the telomere, the diminution of telomeres with time, but certainly telomerase is the enzyme which does this copying mechanism, does the copying at the end of telomeres, and I suppose activating that or upregulating its activity might help a bit, but there's a long way to go before you can say, for example, take an experimental animal like a mouse and artificially extend its telomeres and see how much longer it lives. Personally, I think we all live quite long enough, and I personally wouldn't want to live, I know this is your next show coming up, but I wouldn't want to live much longer than the natural lifespan anyway.
How long does DNA last? You've found it in ancient bones, but what do you think? Yeah. How long could it last?
Well, in some respects, it lasts forever when it's passed down from one person to another. But these are not the original DNA; these are copies. But it has potentially an infinite lifespan through the generations. DNA, the same molecules of DNA. I've extracted DNA from bones of I think the oldest is about 14,000 years old. So very old, really. It's a very stable chemical. And other people have pushed that back to around, I think, 50 or 60,000 years. It's not so much the age that determines whether you can get DNA out of a fossil or a fossil tooth. It's more the conditions in which that skeleton has been preserved. So, for example, in an acid peat bog, bodies don't last very long at all. 100 years later, you won't find any DNA in a body that's in a peat bog. On the other hand, in an alkaline limestone cave, where many have been found, that's where they last the longest. They like to be in cool, limestone cave. So in places like North America, in places like Siberia, in Europe, in cold climates, in limestone caves, is their very favorite location, and they can last. DNA then lasts for thousands and thousands of years.
All right, we've got BJ driving in Florida, east of the Rockies. Good morning, BJ. Go ahead.
Good morning, gentlemen. By the way, congratulations to an old Navy man to another.
Thank you.
wanted to ask a question, and this may be something that you guys have already covered, but they talk about when the Earth was formed and we had what they called Pangaea, and then there was the Great Separation. With any of those mammals or animals that were on those different sections of Pangaea, would that have had anything to do with their particular evolution?
Oh, yes, absolutely. So, for example, the animals, Pangaea, we're all in the same continental, large continent, and then it split up into various continents that we see today. But, for example, in Australia, which split away from the rest of rest of Pangaea and then Gondwana land, took its animals with it, its mammals with it, and they evolved along utterly different lines than in the other parts of the world. And they are they reproduce in a different way. They're called marsupials. When fetuses are born, they're tiny. They crawl into the pouch of the animal, and they're very small, and they're brought up there. Unlike placental mammals like ourselves, where babies are born very fully developed, really, and are capable of independent life. So that's a utterly different evolutionary tree, the placental mammals and the marsupial mammals. There were marsupials in South America as well. And that led to, say, kangaroos, their marsupials. But when the lands began to be connected again and animals would cross from one to the other, on the whole, marsupials were replaced by placentals. In Australia, lots became extinct, and still not all, and the same goes to South America. So, yes, absolutely, evolution occurs in different directions depending on geographic isolation, and that's one very good example.
Okay.
Is that connected to magnetics of hemisphere, weather, hot, cold, this, that, and the other?
Well, I don't think it's much to do with the magnetics. I think it's really to do with chance, one thing. And secondly, with the different environment that you would have found on those separating land masses, they might have led to advantages, for example, in Australia, of being a marsupial, and so they developed their advantages, which were less evident in other parts of the world where the placental mammals evolved.
Do you think we'll ever, Brian, be able to clone a dinosaur, for example, from bones?
Well, of course, this is the wonderful story behind Jurassic Park.
You got it.
And I remember being asked just this question when that wonderful film came out. In that case, what had happened, if you remember, is that DNA had been recovered from mosquitoes that had been encased in amber and were tens of millions of years old. Now, lots of people have tried to find DNA in amber of that sort of age. In many cases, actually stimulated by the appearance of the film, but it's always failed. So I don't think DNA lasts quite as long as tens of millions of years. Thus, a dinosaur bone, and I've looked at some of the fossils. I've never tried to get DNA out of these, but they're completely replaced by stone. They're true fossils. There's no organic material remaining. So if there's no organic material, there's no DNA. But in more recently extinct animals, for example, mammoths, there has been a lot of speculation that perhaps mammoths could be cloned and reproduced. So, in fact, there's even talk, I hope it never happens personally, of now we have a DNA sequence from Neanderthals of cloning a Neanderthal and constructing it just from the sequence, so actually making the DNA synthetically and putting it in some kind of egg and see what happens. I mean, I think I'm not in favor of that myself. For one thing, what do you do with the Neanderthal when it's born? It's not as if you're going to be able to ask it much about what it's like to be a Neanderthal. Anyhow, that's all in the future. It's all science fiction at the moment. But the technology is, it's obviously hard to predict, but it probably will be possible one day. And I didn't think it was when the Jurassic Park came out. I remember being asked the same question. I said, well, you know, it's impossible to actually put the bits of DNA that you'll get out of amber or fossils together in the right order. But I think now you can.
Tell us a little bit, Brian, of where we can get your latest work, DNA USA.
Well, that's a book published in, we haven't talked much about it, have we? But it's published in the US. It was published in May, so it should be, it is certainly available for Amazon and in most good bookshops, I hope. And it's got a lot of things in it. It looks into, for example, the genetic origin of DNA from Europeans, from African-Americans. African-Americans, all of them have European ancestors to different degrees. It identifies the genes that we get from different ancestors. I myself, for example, discovered that I have an African ancestor, DNA ancestor, no idea where from, but that ancestor has given me their genes, and one of them controls my insulin output, so that's quite interesting.
Well, it's a great work, Brian. We're out of time, my friend. Thank you so much for spending the 3 hours with us. Brian Sykes, the work DNA USA. For Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Latasseur, Stephanie Smith, George Knapp, John B. Wells, Ian Puttett, and Art Bell. I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.